control the conversation, right? Am I being heard by the people in the back row? Okay, good. I want to put the points I'm making in the context of the broader cultural situation where we are. We can talk about human sexuality or any other area of inquiry, but when it comes to the human person, it's good to have just an overview, a few broad brushstrokes of the cultural situation. Broader controversy regarding what does it mean to be a human person? We need to ponder these things once in a while. The underlying term there is anthropology. We haven't got time to go into detail, but for instance, is the human person realized substantially in isolation from others or with others? Is the human person realized substantially in isolation whereby others and society are regarded increasingly as the bearers of obligations and I'm the bearer of rights? Is that how it works? That's one picture. Or is human nature an inherently social reality, a reality that simply can't be, that simply can't exist fully in the isolated individual as such? Can I be a fully human on my own? There are those who would say yes. I'm going to have a hazard, I guess, most of us, we would say no. We can't be fully human on our own because of the little thing of personhood. To be a person is to be made for relationship. And as a human person, if I'm trying to realize myself on my own, I'm working against what it is that makes me a human being. And those kind of considerations, they lead on to questions of ethics and morality. If, for instance, being in relation, if that's essential to our human nature, then we need to consider, what does it look like? What does being in relation look like? What's conducive to it? What is destructive of it? And that in turn leads on to considerations of human freedom. Just what is freedom? Is freedom all about the act of choosing and not particularly about choosing well? Choosing in accordance with values that lead to human flourishing? And if freedom is in the service of human flourishing, then the free choice of what is contrary to human flourishing, even though it's a free choice, it ties us up in knots. We all know that prisons are full of people who have exercised free choice. Are they free? Well, by a certain definition, they are. They've exercised free choice, but it's landed them in prison. What if it turns out, I'm firing a load of questions just to set the scene for the few, and they are merely few points that I want to make. What if it turns out that our true nature, the deepest truth about our human reality, what if it turns out that it's the case, it's not that we realize ourselves by being the center of our own universe. What if it turns out that a deeper truth is that we realize ourselves by being satellites, by being in orbit around what we love? And do we need even to demonstrate the truth and attractiveness of that understanding of the human person? Here's a little thought experiment you can do. You can do right here and now. Imagine if we could choose between a world in which everyone does their own thing, with the usual caveat that as long as no one is immediately obviously bloodied, but irrespective of the lasting happiness of others, if we can choose that world where we can all do our thing, or a world in which everyone seeks the happiness of others and everyone understands their own happiness to be linked to the happiness of others, which would we choose? Which sounds like the more inhabitable world? It's a no-brainer, of course. And those considerations and many considerations like them, they're in the background of discussions of human sexuality. Does, for instance, continuing with the questions for a moment, does the fact that we are sexual beings, does that mean that others are there for our gratification? Again, the usual caveat applies, so long as nobody, quote-unquote, gets hurt. Is sexuality a way of being the center of my own universe, or is it a way that's inscribed in all of us of being a satellite? Is it about one's pleasure and satisfaction considered in isolation from the good of others and the good of society? Or is it a way in which we live with and give ourselves to others? so much for the questions. That's just setting the stage, if you will. One of the richest Catholic Church documents on sexuality is a 1995 document entitled The Truth and Meaning of Human Sexuality. Truth and meaning. Those words are at the heart of the matter for those who want to hold and to pass on a sane understanding of human sexuality. Those who hold that sexuality is not indefinitely fluid and plastic and malleable, but that there is a truth, and that if things are forced beyond a certain point, they're liable to be misshapen or even broken. In the US, when they're not busy protecting the president, the Secret Service have another task. They're also the guardians of currency. Now, in an age of, you know, digital currency, that I'm sure their task is changing all the time. But one of their tasks is the policing of counterfeits, of forgeries. How do they learn to spot forgeries? How does a Secret Service agent learn to spot forgeries? Well, in a sense, they don't. Because rather than looking at every single possible forgery, and there's a virtually unlimited range of possibilities, they look at what is true and genuine and original. They become expert in spotting the real thing. And it's against that background of the real thing that they become able to identify forgeries. And something similar could be said of us. We don't all need to know every detail of gender ideology. We don't need to be able to argue every point and correct every misleading or false statistic and every tendentious point that's made. We don't need all to be able to present a careful series of psychological and sociological arguments. My point is that any rejection of what is wrong needs to be based on a vision of what is right. Any no we pronounce needs to be based on a far deeper yes. If I'm critical of various contemporary approaches to human sexuality, but I don't have something better to offer, if I don't have a better vision, to use the title of the book, then I'm just being curmudgeonly. I know what you don't like, Father Ted, down with that sort of thing, but up with what sort of thing, pray tell? So we need to be clear on what our vision is, otherwise we're only carping. We need to be willing and able to offer that better vision. Excuse me if I seem to be labouring a bit. I was saying to David earlier, I'm not toxic, I haven't got a temperature, I don't think I'm a public health menace, but I'm just about on my 2 feet, so praise God for keeping me here. Right, the better vision for which... the better vision, which is the Catholic vision for human sexuality, it's not, and this is an important point, it's not based on some obscure tenets of exclusively Catholic doctrine. It's a statement of observable, lived human sense that can be and is subscribed to by people of all faiths and none. I tend to use the term secular to refer to approaches that are fundamentally at odds with the Catholic vision. And when I do that, really I'm using the term secular as a kind of shorthand, because truth to tell, the Catholic vision in this area can be regarded really as secular itself, in that it works, it is rational, it is coherent in the here and now. It has something to offer to our time, our age, our seculum, which is from the Latin word that gives us the term secular. That said, of course, believers also have the promise of God's grace, which is no small reassurance, given the challenges both personal and cultural faced by anyone who wants to lead a life of genuine self-possession and self-gift. So this better vision of ours, it corresponds to the facts of human nature. It's rational, it's reasonable, it's respectful, it's responsible, it's joyful. So we need to be careful, mindful of those who would dismiss our concerns as merely religious or dogmatic, and therefore not having any place in the public square or in the classroom. Our better vision makes better sense demonstrably. And for the remainder of the talk, I want to just point to a small few aspects of the better vision. Namely, three, that it esteems, this better vision of ours as Catholics, it esteems sex and sexuality. It regards sex as the language of self-gift, and its fundamental principles are more coherent than the secular alternative. First of all, our faith esteems sex and sexuality. Many people, including more than a few Catholics, think that for the church, sex is at best a necessary evil, something to be tolerated rather than celebrated. Happily not true. Our faith esteems sex. It esteems the human body. And that positive attitude goes right back to the beginning of the Bible. Do you know what the first commandment in the Bible is? I'm not speaking about the Ten Commandments. First commandment in the Bible, the first instruction given to men and women. Go forth and multiply. Yeah, Genesis 1:27 are in more colloquial language. Go and make babies. There's no shame or embarrassment. Just a joyful command to produce offspring. Now, things get a little bit more complicated when the human propensity to sin becomes clear, but from the very beginning, it's clear that sex is a gift to men and women, an expression of love directed towards the creation of new life. And there's more. The Bible teaches that not only is sex good, but its goodness is something profound. It's good at a deeper level than, let's say, the way in which food is good, or warm clothes are good, or art or music or sport are good. And because sexuality is so tied up with who we are as human beings, and because it reflects our being created in the image of likeness of God, it's something to be treasured. But it's in the area of sexuality also, and these are hard data of experience, it's in the area of human sexuality that we experience human brokenness. This is an area in which we can be deeply hurt. If you experience an image I like to use, if you experience severe food poisoning, you may be in trouble for a while, but you probably won't need psychological counseling for a long, long time. If you experience sexual abuse, you'll be in serious trouble and you'll need psychological counseling. That makes its own point, I think. So sexuality is both profoundly good and profoundly fragile. What do you do with something that is both precious and fragile? Well, you don't treat it with disregard, you take care of it. And that's what the Christian attitude towards sexuality does. It seeks to take care of the gift, to value it, and in doing so, to respect and value men and women as sexual beings. Now, in a moment, I'll contrast some opposing sets of principles, but now just to note a striking contradiction at the heart of the prevailing secular liberal understanding of sexuality. On the one hand, there is the conviction that sex is pretty much the most important thing there is. Okay, I exaggerate slightly, but I think you know where I'm going. It's the most important form of self-expression and of human freedom. It shouldn't be restricted unduly by moral values. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's no big deal. No consequence, a game, a recreational activity, shouldn't be tied up with commitment, no strings attached, no demands. Is that a mixed message or what? I think it is. Sex is at one and the same time utterly important and of little or no consequence. To my ear, that doesn't sound like the kind of rational, fact-based thinking that some proponents of that understanding say they want to bring to sex education in our schools. Utterly important and of little or no consequence. No, doesn't work. To get to the very heart of the Catholic vision, and this, for anyone who wants to teach or otherwise pass on a sane understanding of human sexuality, this is perhaps the take-home point. Sex is the language of self-gift. I could spend the whole talk and more unpacking that. I could spend the day unpacking it, but let's do so very briefly. Sex is body language, and it says, I am yours, here, I give myself to you, fully, in all my vulnerability, I hold nothing back. That's what it's speaking. That's not the language of a temporary loan, it's the language of complete and permanent self-gift. The body makes a promise of total self-gift, and it's in the nature of total self-gift that it's permanent. There's the old one-liner about the personal ad wanted meaningful overnight relationship. Yeah, we get it. It's impossible because overnight and meaningful don't tally. Now, if we lengthen it out, well, for the weekend, still doesn't work. Wanted meaningful relationship for the summer holiday. No, until Christmas. No, the mere fact of putting a time limit on it explodes it. So sex is a language of permanency. Now, a person might not want sex to speak that language. Their intention might be captured by phrases such as no commitment, no strings attached, just a fling, a one-night stand, what have you. But sex retains its fixed inner meaning irrespective of that contrasting intention. And no matter what way it's used, it remains the language of complete self-gift, of permanency. And when it's understood and used casually, without regard to deeper truths and values, human beings suffer. And when human beings suffer in substantial numbers, society suffers, common good suffers. And then there's the incidental fact that this whole business is how other human beings are brought into the world. But that happens, or should happen, in the context of a loving communion of life. And all of this is the language of sex. It speaks of communion and of self-gift and of permanency. And that's why a wise person has said that Christians are people who make love only to those to whom they have made promises. A very wise remark. Now, I can feel the feasibility, the realism question crowding into my mind as I talk, and thus I get to it. How realistic is this? I'll get to that near the very end. I want to share with you two competing sets of principles. One way to understand our Catholic vision for human sexuality is to compare it with other understandings. So I want to consider the fundamental principles underlying the common secular vision of sex and those underlying our better vision. The prevailing secular approach to sex has two broad but simple principles: consent and hygiene. If you have consent and you're taking precautions, you're good to go. That sounds like a caricature, but in fact it's not. Read around a bit and you'll find that it does reduce. And again, I'm not trying to suggest either that despite those terribly frail philosophical underpinnings, that every secular person is just sort of a public health menace. No, I'm not saying that. And it's important to be realistic about these things. A lot of very good, responsible people don't have a deep philosophical foundation to which they can appeal, but it doesn't mean they're not good and responsible people. It means their position is questionable at best. So, if you have consent and you're taking precautions, you're good to go. And in that secular approach, the rightness or wrongness of sexual activity is determined not by any underlying convictions regarding human flourishing or happiness, but by concern for sovereign, in-the-moment, individual freedom. That's where it's at, along with concern for health. And in that view, sex is of no particular import, either morally or spiritually. Once pregnancy and infection are avoided, and there's consent, then consensual sex is a no-string attached activity with no lingering effects or obligations. But if we're to be perfectly frank, that understanding is more likely to facilitate the sexually predatory and irresponsible than it is to guide those who are searching for love and commitment. It hardly needs to be said, but perhaps it's not harm to say it, that there's nothing in the Catholic vision that implies that sex, that consent is unimportant. Of course it's unimportant. Of course it's important, pardon me. But as a fundamental principle for guiding sexual behaviour, it's utterly inadequate. And it's being increasingly criticised by commentators, secular commentators, from all over. I'm thinking of two. One of them, I'm not sure how secular she is anymore. She seems to be on, I gather, her own pilgrimage. Louise Perry in the UK, Christine Emba in New York, young women scholars have recently written very cogently debunking the common take on consent as an adequate criterion, and ponder how many people have messed up their lives, how many marriages have been destroyed and careers ended by a moment of perfectly consensual stupidity. So much for the secular guiding principles of consent and hygiene. For Christians, two very different principles apply to human sexuality: the principle of the dignity of the human person and what I'm calling the marriage principle. The first of those refers to the fact that every single human person has a dignity that must never be violated. The person must never be treated in a sub-personal or impersonal way by being used or by being regarded merely as a means to an end. And it's moving oil in the area of sexuality that human beings tend to be used without regard for their dignity. And so the principle of the dignity of the human person, it applies with particular clarity in this area. While there are degrees of moral failing, of course, we don't throw the kitchen sink at everything. It's not the Catholic way. There are degrees of moral failing, prudence, discernment, charity, of course. But the fact is that whenever sexual pleasure is sought with little or no or insufficient thought regarding the good of the other person, then there is disregard in some measure of their dignity. And the good of the other person is something far richer and more complex and more lasting and more long-term than can be captured in a legalistic understanding of in-the-moment consent. Let's face it, people can get the consent of sexual partners in whose long-term welfare they have no interest. That's the simple reality. So that's the dignity of the human person. Second principle, the marriage principle, the second principle that guides or should guide the behavior of Christians, the marriage principle. Sex is about complete communion between two people. It's the language of self-gift and of permanency. It's a language inscribed in the bodily difference between man and woman. It's a language that says yes, always in principle and sometimes in practice, to the arrival of a new life. And if sex is used to speak of a temporary or disposable relationship, it is being used to say something untrue. And if the intention is for sex to say nothing of any significance, that too is a lie, because sex, as we have seen, it is inherently meaningful. It's designed with meaning. So the marriage principle is, something of an axis, a center around which we can say all other aspects of sexuality rotate. When we're clear that sex belongs in marriage and only there, and I'm touching up against the realism question in a moment, when we're clear that sex belongs there and only there, then we're no longer, if we ever were, we're not singling out other behaviors for some unique criticism. Rather, we are seeing them through the lens of the marriage principle. So, for instance, there isn't a separate morality for homosexuality. There isn't some separate set of moral categories. We're seeing everything through the principle of the dignity of the human person and the marriage principle. So, the realism question, is this difficult and demanding? Oh yeah. Is it ever? Is it countercultural? Oh yeah, and some. Is it realistic? That's a big question, needs more time than we have. But what I want to do, by way of a brief answer, I want to stack it up against another question and consider long-term outcomes and short-term outcomes. The secular approach, it's like what's the diet? There's a new diet out and it's really tremendous. You can eat anything you want at any time you want, as much as you want. You don't lose any weight, but it's very easy to stick to. Now, the skittishness aside, well, I think that's not entirely off the pitch here, because the secular approach is very easy to stick to, but you don't lose any of the deadness, the accretion, your soul, your spirit, your family, your society. So let me stack these two questions face to face with each other. Is this Catholic vision for human sexuality, is it realistic? And the other question is the trajectory we currently find ourselves on, with its confusion, its brokenness, its off-the-chart statistics for STDs, its sadness and anxiety, is this trajectory realistic in the longer term? Pardon the understatement, but I would say that the indications are not universally encouraging. And however demanding, we need to be acquiring and promoting a better vision. Now, I can David, how long more have I got in the north? About 5 minutes. Ah, yeah, well, then I'll I'm going to just finish, drop words at close. We Catholics were sometimes accused of being a little bit obsessed with sin, even still by certain secular commentators. I think we're, when do you hear about sin anymore? I'm sorry for mentioning it. I'm professional nice guy. I'm not meant to mention these things. But when we're talking about sin in this context, what we are touching on is observable and empirical. We're talking about the brokenness of humanity in the sphere of sexuality. That's part of our social and personal experience. And whether we use the faith language of sin or more secular, sociological, psychological terms to describe that brokenness, it is clear, isn't it, that we need to exercise some care when it comes to sex and sexuality. We need to do something more than just go with the flow of desires, impulses, and urges. And we need to be inculcating that in those who are still finding their way in this world, younger people, children, adolescents, young adults. And because we all share in some measure in this brokenness, we proclaim our understanding of sexuality gently, compassionately. This vision is not it's not a cudgel with which to hammer others. The book, by the way, is very soft paperback. It's nervous for hitting anyone over the head with. It's just, I should have thought of that when I was having it done. Think about this is medicine for healing. It's a kindly wisdom for our walk through life. If you think about your own relationships for a moment, if you're married, ask yourself how important in your marriage are realities like commitment, self-restraint, self-gift, sacrifice, love. Would your marriage work without them? Hardly. Priesthood doesn't work without them either. And that's because those attitudes, mindsets, ways of being in the world, they're simply necessary for healthy and done living. Who is teaching these values? Our children and young people. How much mention of self-gift and of self-sacrifice do we find in our school programs? How much talk of love? And isn't it interesting and very telling that I'm open to correction on this. I don't want to overstate, but I'm practically certain. Perhaps David might or somebody might be able to confirm, but isn't it interesting that pretty much the only reference in current school curricula to conception is when they're talking about contraception. So it's not making babies in a committed relationship, it's avoiding babies in a non-committed relationship. It's not a great head start in life for youngsters, I would suggest. And that's not being cynical, that's being deadpan realistic. It's not a great start. There are mentions of care and respect in the new programs, and who would argue with that? But who is to teach our youngsters that self-gift is about more than, to use a phrase from a recent NCCA document, more than consent, intimacy, and mutual pleasure? Now, to consent, intimacy, and mutual pleasure, we're not saying down with that sort of thing. We're not against them at all. But those things should be and are part of a deeper and more far-reaching reality. If we seek to educate our youngsters in sexuality, but we don't teach and model and inculcate things like self-gift, self-restraint, sacrifice, and commitment, then we are leaving them ill-equipped, if not actually handing them over to a world of disposable relationships and broken hearts, because they need more than the plumbing. They need the bigger vision, the better vision. Thank you.